right, welcome back, everybody. We're here for another rousing episode of The Creative Genius, and we got a little bit of new news here. Looks like Adam, you put something in about the Google Home and it always listening. So that sounds pretty intriguing. Maybe something that invades our privacy a little bit. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going on there?
Yeah. So full disclaimer, you and I are both sick. I think we should mention that now because we don't sound like ourselves, our normal, happy, you know, go lucky selves. So just throwing that out there.
We're doing our best.
Yeah. We're trying so hard.
Full of NyQuil and disappointment.
Yeah. So Google Home. Yeah. So the Google Home Mini, which was a product that was announced pretty recently from Google, came out, and we talked a lot about privacy and things like that. And one thing we haven't really talked about is like the whole smart speaker market. But kind of on our topic of privacy, there was a bug discovered in the Google Home. I'm going to put finger quotes around bug because of, you know, how we talked about Google in the last couple episodes. But come to find out that it was always triggering the listen button, and basically it was listening to every conversation that you had. So basically this little, you know, speaker that's sitting in your house is like a fly on the wall, but much like tapping your phones, like they had tapped your house, you know, so whatever you were saying was getting sent, uploaded to Google. Google was trying to parse it and seemingly do nothing with that data. But the researcher or the person who was, you know, using this just looked on their app and saw a bunch of stuff and, hey, that's not right. And then they contact Google and they find out, oh, like it's a hardware bug. So we're just going to disable that button for everybody. So right now, every single Google Home Mini out there doesn't have the ability to listen in because it was discovered that they were always listening without your permission. So.
So this was like the bug, the button on the top of the device, right, Adam? Like basically the button on the top of the device thought it was always being pressed. So the user was like always issuing a command to it. I just briefly read something about it this week. So I want to clarify for everybody out there, it's the button on top.
Yeah, yeah. So the whatever feature was to tap, it's a capacitive button or whatever it is. That's my understanding as well, is that button was always triggering, so it was always listening.
Interesting. That's definitely creepy, and I'm glad they disabled it.
Well, I mean, they just disabled that whole feature for everybody now. I mean, that's kind of like a pretty big like turnaround. Like, oh, oops. Well, we'll just disable that feature completely. Well, that doesn't seem like the right way to do it, unless it was something in hardware, in which case it's like, well, yeah, you can try to, you know, just put a kill switch on in software, but the fact that this was even there, there's a lack of either quality control or, you know, just something else going on in the workings there.
Yeah, it's tough to understand why this wasn't caught in QA or something before it got out to the reviewers who were, you know, kind of stumbling upon this issue. And it's something that I think I understand from a PR perspective why they did it, because it's easier to just say, well, we're just going to pull the plug on this completely. That way there's no ambiguity about is it still doing it or not. And you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Google Home Mini comes out in a year and voila, there's a new button and it works this time. You know, they just kind of kick the can down the road and let the articles go away. And now it's a new feature for the next one.
Yeah, no, I think what's going to happen is they're just like, oh, crap, they found out we were listening all the time. Well, now we got to make sure that those recordings are invisible so they don't see them. That's what I think it is. That's just me being pessimistic.
I think everyone is trying to play catch up with Amazon. And, you know, Amazon was really they were the first folks to really get, a head start in this particular realm of technology. Right. So they were, you know, the first ones who came out with Alexa and, you know, that whole talking into the air and it answering whatever questions you want. So, I mean, really becoming a handless assistant, which is in a lot of ways convenient. It's very nice. You know, it's a very new technology and I don't know that you can necessarily pin all the blame on like their quality assurance team or whatever, but I think what source of issues might be that they're trying to do things too quickly, and I feel like everyone feels like they're behind. I mean, there's a lot of tech companies that could make something like this. I mean, Microsoft could make a Cortana type of deal, but they haven't yet, or if they even plan to. And then you have, you know, Apple's technology that they're going to be coming out with later this year, and then you have Google trying to keep up with Amazon, and then Amazon just seems to be ahead of the curve on all of it. So maybe Google just feels like they're a little bit stressed out and trying to get it out too quickly, and this is something that they just may have overlooked.
Well, rush to market's one excuse, right? Like, I mean, yeah, you can say that we were rushing to get this out, you know, and that, you know, caused a whole slew of issues. But something like this is pretty glaring, right? I mean, like, I don't want to give them like a pass just because, you know, they were struggling to get something out there, right? Like, just like we wouldn't give any other company a pass on this, you know, it's like, hey, if we found out Amazon was secretly recording everything you said, then great. And all of these devices technically do, right? Because they're constantly parsing for this, you know, this trigger word and then looking for what comes after the trigger word. So I agree with you that, yeah, like there's a dominant player in this market, someone who's been there for a while and kind of almost, you know, like jump-started the whole thing. But that's still no excuse for a company to like have a bug where they're always listening to your recording or always listening to, you know, their surroundings. In this sense, I don't think that's a, you know, they don't get a pass, you know, just because they were rushing to market.
Sure.
Yeah, this is a pretty big bug, but you know, I mean, maybe in the future we'll do a smart speaker or whatever you want to call it episode. So we can dive deeper into it, if, you know, later on, I'm sure.
So in the world of Mother Nature, doing a lot of crazy stuff and continuing to do some crazy stuff, you know, we've had the hurricanes, we've had the earthquakes, and now we have some crazy fires. We've had some in Anaheim, and now we have some crazy ones in Northern California. Adam, you kind of live in that area. Have you run into any trouble with any of those fires that are going on up there?
Yeah, I think we should like stop talking about natural disasters, because every time we do, it seems to get worse like the next week. So like us even talking about it, I feel like is jinxing us, you know?
Seriously.
But no, so thanks for asking. In Santa Cruz, we're still okay. You can definitely like smell the smoke like once I get into, you know, into the valley. But we're not in any danger right now, right? But it's just kind of crazy seeing the amount that has burned and the amount of structures that have been lost, and the amount of, you know, deaths that there have been. And I've lived through wildfires, you know, throughout my entire life. And we actually had to evacuate 1 year because the fire got within, you know, 10 miles of our house. So this isn't as close as that is, but it just, the scale of it seems so much larger. And then kind of tearing through, you know, pretty densely populated areas, and so quick too, right? Like you hear some of the stories of, you know, people are like, huh, you know, like I saw a couple embers, you know, like kind of floating over. And then, you know, maybe 45 seconds later, the fire was like right up to the house. And then maybe 5 minutes later, the whole house burnt down. Right. So it's like, and this is kind of one of those things, right? I made fun of Lou for trying to outrun an earthquake, you know, and a fire is something you can seemingly try to outrun. Right. But some of these fires, just with the winds and the conditions, the way they are right now, it is wildfire season where things just move so quickly. And it's so hard to contain a fire where, you know, there's 40 plus mile hour winds every night, you know, like, so even at night when, you know, it's cooler out, you're trying to, you know, like contain this fire that just keeps changing direction or hopping freeways, or, you know, it's really difficult to kind of contain. But luckily there has been progress made, and hopefully by the time this comes out, to listeners, that will have been resolved. But it's been, nature has been, a cruel mistress these days.
What's kind of crazy to think too is, and I'll drop a link in the show notes as well about fire safety and precautions that you can take to protect yourself and your home. But what's really interesting about all this is a really, relatively speaking, in Earth's history, this is actually really a very calm time for weather, even in terms of what's happening now. And I can only really imagine what weather, like real extreme weather, would really be like in the times that, you know, humans weren't able to observe it. Because I mean, what we're experiencing now just seems like the whole United States is on fire at every moment. And it's like you say, it seems like every time we talk about this, there's just something new that's worse and more harmful. And I mean, there's wildfires all the time, but the death toll usually isn't as high as it has been. I mean, have you guys noticed a difference in that? Is, I feel like the severity of this is a lot more intense than it ever has been.
Well, that's a good point, right? Like this is relatively calm in terms of like historical, you know, events. But the difference is when they start moving through like the heavily populated areas, right? Now we're talking about, you know, 100 years ago, even, right? There was not near as many people as there are right now, and we're packing people into smaller and smaller places, and we're moving them farther and farther out, you know, doing all these other things. where now there's just such a higher probability for that kind of thing, because whenever this happens, it's usually pretty close to people, right? You talk about like the fires that would happen in Yellowstone, right? All the time, like every so many years, there would be this big, you know, wildfire, and that was just part of like the cycle, part of nature's cycle, right? Where it burned down everything, like all of that would, you know, go into the soil and then just like sprout up the next generation of trees and wildlife and things like that. But I think now, like just because of where people are and just the sheer amount of people, that's why we have so many more deaths in these kind of, you know, disasters. As far as like history setting, right? Like it's a series of wildfires up here, but the combined death toll is greater than I think anyone in California's history. And part of that is Southern Californians not wanting to leave their homes too, you know?
Yeah.
And it's crazy to point out, like, I'm pretty sure that the death toll for these fires is exceeding some of the most recent hurricanes that we've had, which is kind of hard to fathom because, I mean, these hurricanes, when we hear about them, people often go days and weeks, you know, afterwards without power, and they're in sweltering heat. And these fires, I feel like more prepared for them in the way that we have, you know, mass systems that can go ahead and alert people, and people can get out and know the direction the fire is coming from and everything. And we do know some of that with hurricanes, but it seems in a lot of ways we're more prepared for fires, or we should be more prepared. And it's sad to hear that so many people have lost their lives in these particular fires. And one point of just sort of hypocrisy to me is that the fires in Northern California in particular, I don't know, this is just by nature, I assume, but the winds that Northern California has are called Diablo winds, I guess. And down here in Southern California where we are, they are the Santa Ana winds. And I'd never heard the term the Diablo winds before, but I really think we should make a movement to rename the name of those winds, because it's kind of evil considering they're causing the fires right now.
Well, they're just helping the fires along, you know.
I guess so. And I mean, you know, when I think of Diablo, I already think of fire, and I think of, you know, flames and burning, and so that this just doesn't seem to be the right name for them. We should probably consider renaming them.
Yeah, when I hear Diablo, I just think of cows.
I think probably the scariest thing about these fires is the smoke. You know, I mean, that's the real killer, you know.
Yeah, man, that's why I'm sick, right? Mm-hmm. Nope, that's not it. I have 3 incubators at home that, you know, just bring home every disease imaginable. And like, hey, Dad, how's it going? How was your day at school? Great, thanks. Awesome.
I needed those things. So it was kind of a big weekend for Lou and myself. We both had a birthday. So happy birthday to you, Mr. Lou.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim, and happy birthday to you as well. How is it feeling another year older?
You know, it's funny. I've always, when I was younger, I used to think about, you know, when I was, I don't know, 8, I think about, man, I'm turning 10, I'm finally going to be in the double digits. When I was 10, I think about, man, I'm going to be a teenager at 13. And then at 13, you thought about 16, and then you thought about 18, and then I kind of thought about 21. But I never really thought beyond 21. You know, the only thing I ever really thought about was, you know, if I ever travel, I can, you know, rent a car if I really wanted to or whatever. But I never really thought about my life at this place. And I'm always kind of like a 10-year ahead kind of guy. But it's kind of weird living in a place where I didn't really consider what my life would be like at this age. So it's kind of a, I don't know, I guess a quarter life crisis, if you want to call it, but not really, because I'm not freaking out about it. But it's just an interesting perspective, I guess, that I haven't really thought about my life at this point. So it's kind of making me think about what I'm going to be like in my 30s and so forth and whatnot. But overall, pretty good. I'm pretty happy with everything. I got good things going for me right now. How about yourself?
I'm just happy I'm still younger than Adam.
Yeah, that will always be true. But you know,
yeah, I as long as I can always refer to Adam as the old man of the group, I'm A-okay, which I don't think I'll have a problem doing that, unless we invent time machines. So for right now, I'm pretty happy. Yeah, getting older sucks. Let's just put it that way. Anyway, moving on.
Hey, no, you can't just move on from that. I mean, like, I can honestly say, like, to Jim's point, right? Like, you kind of, there are these kind of milestones where it almost is a change of perception, right? And just your way of thinking, like, okay, well, you know, I'm excited to get to this age, or I'm excited to get to this age. And there's kind of a threshold where, like, around 25, right, where you're just like, okay, well, I think I'm, you know, figuring my stuff out, right? I'm figuring my shit out. Like, I'm not getting any younger, and there's not much to look forward to, you know, like, in terms of milestones of, you know, oh, like, I've almost unlocked all the achievements that I can get in this video game now, you know, like, I can say, like, hey, like, there's nothing else I can do on my own, right? I need someone else to help me with these other achievements, or blah, blah, blah. But for me, like, honestly, like, yeah, I'm the oldest one of the group, but that doesn't bother me in the least, right? And I kind of stopped thinking about that, right? Like, when I hit 30, everyone was like, oh my God, you're 30. Like, what's life going to be like now? How does it feel? I'm like, you know what? Like, I already feel older than I am because of, you know, the state I'm at in my life in comparison to, like, how other people have progressed through theirs, just in terms of the family and kids and stuff. And I'm just happy, you know, to be here every year. It's like, okay, cool. Yeah, I stopped counting because there's more important things to do with my life. But yeah, I'll always be older than you, Lou, so you always have to give me respect and actually listen to the things that I say. So, touche, you know.
I don't respect my elders, so take that.
Little jackass. You know, back in the days when I was still going to school, they would actually beat you with, you know, rulers and stuff, so.
Oh, what a time.
That's not true.
My father beat me. It's okay. I got the belt like, 2 or 3 times, so.
Wow. A little too deep there.
Dad, if you're listening.
I just want to say happy birthday to both of you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
I know I sent Jim balloons. Not the real ones, but digital ones.
You did. I really appreciated those balloons.
Yeah, I didn't send any message with the balloons. I just sent the balloons.
I think you technically got more than me, Jim, then, because I was told just to take the day off from doing anything with the podcast.
Yeah, man. That no, I lectured you on your birthday. I basically told you, I was like, hey, like, why are you working on your birthday? You're like, oh man, I'll always work. And I was like, don't do anything. Like, enjoy your day off. You didn't even do that.
Nah, yeah, I didn't really do that. I was doing productive things anyway, so.
On your birthday. And then you try to tell me, like, oh, it's my birthday week, I can slack off. It's like, no. Your birthday, you can slack off. Like, that was your day. You didn't get the whole week. You don't get the whole month.
I also worked on my birthday.
Okay, well, maybe it's just a perspective thing. Like, maybe you have to hit 30 to realize that you should at least enjoy the time that you can have off. Like, take your birthday off.
I meant to take it off, but then I, you know, I've had so many things going on this month that I have already taken quite a bit of time off, more than I probably should have, But looking back on it, I feel like I should have taken the day anyway.
So wait, yeah, well, because it wasn't just your birthday that you had. You also had a night of debauchery, right?
There was a night of debauchery, absolutely.
How was that?
It was a great time. I mean, I didn't get out there until pretty late. Someone that you and I know, Lou, is he's getting married, and I was invited along to his bachelor party in San Diego, and I didn't get out there until probably 11, but we stayed out in the gas lamp until probably like 3 in the morning. And we found this really awesome bar. It was all these old school gaming machines. Like, there were pinball machines and that wooden ball that you toss. What's that? Ski ball? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's ski ball.
And then those Mortal Kombat, you know, you have the joystick and the two buttons where you can jump and kick and stuff. Like, it was really fun. We spent a good amount of time in there. It was just this really solid time. We went all around the gas lamp, and it was just really fun. It was just really fun.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's why you're still sick. But hey, man, you made the most of it.
I couldn't bring it down, you know, like, I didn't want to take away his, you know, I didn't want to take away his thunder. You know, that wouldn't have been cool.
Right. It's just like why we're still here tonight, right? Like, we don't want to, you know, have excuses for like, oh, we missed it because we were sick. Yeah.
So we got some stuff in follow-up, it looks like. Some CD-ROM business. CD-ROM RPMs of 52 times, it looks like, equals 10,400. Does someone want to explain a little bit more about what's going on there?
Yeah, that's my shorthand for last episode, I was like, hey, how fast did, you know, CDs spin until they exploded, or how fast did they actually spin?
Oh, yeah.
So I looked it up, and the actual RPMs for 52X, which was, I believe, at least from my recollection, one of the fastest speeds in terms of reading on a CD-ROM, was 10,400 RPMs, which is pretty darn fast when you think of it. Considering, you know, modern hard drives, most of them, you know, spin at 72. I know there are 15K spindles, like 15,000 RPMs for hard drives, but kind of a nice thing for CD-ROMs. 52X was roughly around 10,000 RPM. So hearing that thing spin up in your CD drive always gave me just this little, you know, sense of satisfaction.
Yeah.
Gotta love it.
That's really fast. That is,
well,
that
not
is
that fast.
Really, really fast. That's really fast.
I mean, it's pretty fast, but not that fast.
That's pretty quick. Pretty quick. I mean, it's funny how CDs were just like the epitome of technology, and then now it's like fading.
Well, yeah, it's like everything, right? It's like, man, can't get much better than this. And then it's like, oh, wait, I can fit MP3s onto CDs and fit, you know, 800 times more, you know, and they still kind of sound okay, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like the death of everything physical or something like that.
Oh, yeah, I think we talked about that.
But I don't know, something like that.
That would be a great show idea. We should write that down for some other time.
We'll vote on it. So RAID 6. So RAID, I've been reading up a little bit about it, so I have a better understanding, because when you guys were talking about it, I wasn't quite sure of what all that was.
You like the ant spray? Like, yeah, I mean, I've used that, you know.
Yeah, so a lot of stuff about cockroaches, a lot of stuff about a lot of stuff about ants and bugs in general, just not a whole lot about technology.
And then once you put in the periods in between everything, you're like, oh, I get it now.
There we go. So RAID, to be a little bit more specific, a redundant array of independent disks, as it's known. And we have RAID 6. So what does that mean? What is that all about?
Yeah, so I dropped this in the outline for this week, but basically, I think we didn't mention RAID 6 last week, but basically RAID 6 is just an offshoot of RAID that allows for two drive redundancy, just so if more than one drive fails, you know, basically you have two drives that have that same copy of the data on it, and of course this is all kind of striped data, so it's mixed among all the drives. But this is becoming even more and more important today, because a lot of the drives that we have are much larger today, and so rebuilding the drives takes much longer. So if you have, you know, four drives that are all 8 terabytes, and your one drive goes down, when you put a brand new 8 terabyte in there, the RAID controller's got to go through and rebuild that new drive, and that could take, I mean, quite some time in today's standards. And so, God forbid another drive goes down in that process, RAID 6 kind of allows for just a little extra coverage, but obviously is going to eat up significantly more drives and more costs. But it has its upsides, and especially if you're in business, maybe this would be pretty important. Otherwise, I don't know. For my personal use, I've only used single drive redundancy.
Yeah, so RAID 6 is just one level above RAID 5, right? RAID 5 had one disk of parity. RAID 6 has two disks of parity. Like I said, it just allows for you one extra drive to fail. But essentially just, you know, RAID 5 plus 1, hence RAID 6. It's funny, Jim, you mentioned it's a redundant array of independent disks, but I believe it used to be inexpensive disks.
Oh.
Because, like, before hard drives reached these massive capacities of, you know, 8 terabytes and, you know, such and such, they're very, very tiny. So RAID was kind of the one easy way it was to, you know, get a large amount of space without spending a fortune for a single drive of the same capacity. So I know lately it's moved to independent disks, but I'll always remember it as redundant array of inexpensive disks. Another old man thing, I guess.
Interesting. It just means you have wisdom.
Limited wisdom.
I mean, it's ever increasing and at a faster rate than mine and or Lou's.
I don't know, man. Like, I feel like when you're in school, that's kind of the pinnacle of, you know, absorbing knowledge. Maybe because school mixed with other activities in your 20s, maybe there's a correlation there. But I can honestly say that the older I get, like, the more curious I am. And the more that I find I'll latch onto a certain thing, and I'll want to learn everything I can learn about that one thing. But as far as like general knowledge about just everything, like that is less appealing to me, right? It's like, I'm like, hey, if I'm going to go for this, you know, like if I invest my time, I might as well learn everything there is to know about this. So naturally that means I have a laundry list of things that I want to learn. It's just finding the time to commit and actually learn all those things is very tough. So, I don't know about wisdom ever growing. Like maybe I'll learn one new thing a year, but I'll know the shit out of that one thing.
I feel like I have kind of, like an average knowledge about a lot of different things, but I don't know everything about one thing. I always feel like I'm meeting people who know more things about a particular subject than I do.
I feel like that's really interesting for me to hear the two of you explain that, because I am in the middle of you both in terms of age. And I remember the days of being in school where I kind of felt like I was learning 20 things at once, and I was only kind of absorbing like 80% of what I was trying to learn out of all of them, because my brain just couldn't shove all that in at one time and really unmaster everything. And then I understand Adam's sentiment of like, I feel like I don't learn as much anymore, but things I do learn, I fully master today and can retain and understand, which is pretty awesome. I don't know. It's interesting to hear you both describe that. I definitely resonate with that.
That's got to be a really interesting place for you to be in, because you are right in the middle.
I definitely am.
Is that awkward middle child?
And I can definitely see both sides of where you guys are coming from.
Jack of all trades, but a master of none.
Master of None is supposed to be a really good show, but I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, it's so good.
I mean, I love Aziz Ansari, so I'm in, but I've heard it's supposed to be really good.
Take your time with watching it. He's not going to be making the third season for a while.
Yeah.
I was watching a few interviews, and I really want to read his book. But I guess making that TV series kind of, you know, had him fall into a depressive state, and he needs some time to kind of recuperate, which is pretty interesting. I mean, I hope he's okay, and I hope he does well. He's one of those people that he's a good actor and a good person simultaneously. I feel like if I met him, he'd just be really humble, just kind of cool guy to talk to. But he makes quality television. So if you ever do get a chance, watch that show. Definitely a good one. So on to the show. We got talking about technology and nature. Kind of how they tie together a little bit, whether it's good things that come out of nature or bad things that come out of it, or how we affect it or it affects us, kind of things. And so, you know, we've benefited a lot from nature and technology and the stuff that we make. So, you know, there's some technology that's been inspired by nature. I have a link in the show notes. So, you know, something that we have is, you know, something like, you know, Velcro and other things like that. That's all technology that was inspired by nature. Did you guys happen to see anything else that kind of intrigued you as far as things that we've created that's been inspired by, you know, animals or things that we've just observed?
I like the shark skin one. I've always like had a fascination about sharks, and just kind of, you know, how they're, you know, one of the largest and oldest, you know, predators in the ocean. It's always been really interesting to see like anything that they take from that, right? In terms of, you know, even like radar, like echolocation, stuff like that, right? Even getting more into the sea life part. One of my daughters is obsessed with dolphins, right? So she talks about that all the time. It's really cool to see how, I mean, there's all sorts of cool examples that you put in this link here, but just how we do take a lot of influence and a lot of inspiration from things that we've seen. And nature is kind of like the ultimate, you know, like playground for those types of things. Like, wow, that's really cool how, you know, this creature has kind of evolved to do this, or this creature has, you know, adapted to its environment in this way. It's like, how can we take that into a practical application for, you know, our benefit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, I mean, and we were talking about this in one of our previous shows. I think it might have been the last one, where we were talking about CRISPR and, you know, the technology to kind of eradicate diseases or whatever the case may be, or build buildings in an efficient way that it maximizes space and energy efficiency, or, you know, Velcro or whatever. You know, those things already exist, right? I mean, this isn't new technology. You know, this stuff has already been made just biologically. We're making it artificially now. And so we're just using the blueprints that already exist to, you know, our benefit. And it's, you know, gotten us all the way to, you know, our upper atmosphere and beyond. I mean, it's pretty amazing what we've been able to observe and put into practice.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to see. And I kind of, when I looked at this, I one of the things that kind of came to mind is really how we've been able to use technology to be more efficient in nature, I guess. And so I kind of took it from the angle of you know, for hundreds of years as humans, we've had to, you know, go from sort of hunter gatherers to, you know, planting crops to where we are today, where we sometimes move crops from, you know, vast ends of the earth to us based on seasons. I mean, you can get a crop that's out of season in almost any, you know, section of America any time of year, just because people will fly it or, you know, truck it or whatever needs to happen. And so one of the things that's the craziest about technology for me and how we've been able to advance our use of nature, if you will, is sort of how we plant and use crops to both use soil year round. And we get like the most high efficient crop planting of today. And for better or for worse, we even, you know, sometimes modify the crops to provide like the most optimal output, which is just mind-boggling how far we've come in even just 50 and 100 years in terms of just planting and growth for food for ourselves.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that was really a big thing just for humanity in general was agriculture. You know, I mean, that was, I feel like that's really the cornerstone of civilization. You know, we had more stuff than we could carry. And so we ended up just settling. And so then we had to figure out, well, I can't just keep hunting all the time. We also need to, you know, eat something else and have it be sustainable. And so, you know, we learned how things grow in Earth's soil and kind of, and use that to our advantage. And, you know, it's led to the great cities that we have now, you know, New York and London and Paris and, you know, great civilizations.
Yeah, it's funny too, because you see like a lot of startups coming up too, like you mentioned New York, right? Where there's a lot of cityscapes and a lot of, you know, kind of just man-made structures. Not as much like wildlife and like vegetation as there used to be. So now they're, you know, like moving into, you know, ways of still being able to grow and sustain crops, even in New York City, right? Where there's a large amount of, you know, space in terms of, you know, real estate, but not a lot of, you know, clean air or sunlight or et cetera, et cetera. So they're finding ways to like kind of, you know, I forget exactly what the term is, but, you know, grow all the crops indoors and find like a space efficient way to basically grow large amounts of crops to feed, you know, and continue to use just that real estate for agriculture.
I mean, it's pretty cool how we can put our technology forward like that. And what might even be more astounding as well is when we damage the environment, we have ways of fixing some of the stuff that we've done. For example, the, you know, bees are on the decline, and bees are very, very important to our environment. Very important to me having avocado toast when I want it and when it's convenient for me. And I'll tell you, it's very often. And without bees, I wouldn't have my avocado toast.
It's such like a Californian first world problem too. We're like, oh man, what are we going to do without avocados?
Yo, need them.
California hipster, totally.
Well, okay, the avocado toast part is California hipster, but I mean, just avocados. Like, I love avocados. Like, I have them, you know, like every week on my, you know, breakfast sandwich that I get with eggs and bacon and avocado on it, right? Kids love avocado. Like, one of them will just eat like a whole avocado by herself, you know? But that's such a California problem. Like, man, what about avocados? Like, we didn't think about like all the other crops, you know, things like that actually produce like more than just one thing. You know, avocados give you avocados and like, you know, some guacamole and avocado toast.
I have a sort of luxury at my disposal is that I'm fairly good friends with an avocado grower, and he supplies to Chipotle. But this further drives home my point of like, we've learned how to be very efficient, and we can't grow avocados in California year round. at least in good quantity and at low, you know, churn or dollars for the business. And so he has groves in both Mexico and in Chile, just to be able to support his business year round. And those get shipped, and it's amazing that we can get those avocados year round. But it's obviously it's for the benefit of people like Jim who want their avocado toast.
Absolutely, it's to my benefit.
Yeah, kind of to Jim's point, like if there are no bees, then you can't get avocados nowheres.
No, which is why we've kind of started inventing little bee drones, right, and other ways of pollinating, because we're taking away nature's pollinators, so we have to put in artificial ones. I mean, that kind of gets into kind of the stuff that we take away from nature a little bit. But when you know, the cool thing is that we can develop technology that mimics what nature is already able to do. You know, we're kind of at that place in technology where, you know, if we take something from nature, we can put it back. You know, we're kind of teetering that on that line now where, you know, we have unlocked a lot of amazing small technology. I mean, we're bordering on the even in the quantum world, but you know, this whole talk about drones has been really important in terms of keeping pollinating going.
Yeah, but it's like that movie Bee Movie. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, absolutely, great one.
Great, yeah, okay. With Jerry Seinfeld, it was awesome.
Yeah,
but I can honestly say I didn't see that movie until like a year ago when it came on Netflix, and the kids were like, "Let's watch this movie." I'm like, you know what? I've heard so many things about this movie. I've never watched it. And it basically talks about, yeah, a post-apocalyptic world where the bees stop pollinating because they're not getting paid and all the humans are taking all their honey, which is what they, you know, work for. It's what they work to produce, you know. They're like, we work so hard to produce this and you humans just take it and you put it on your avocado toast. But yeah, how basically once the bees stop doing their jobs, you know, and like get into this cushy lifestyle of not working, you know, then all the crops start dying and all the flowers start dying and everyone's like, what's happening? What's wrong? We don't understand. It's like, well, there's no bees. Like, those plants can't do everything themselves, you know? And that's one other way that nature's kind of like, nature found a way, you know? Basically to help themselves reproduce and, you know, keep the cycle going. So, yay for us for making bee drones. Bad for us for killing all bees.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of the bee movie, I mean, that was such a brilliant way to make it relevant to people, because you work for money, and if you don't get money, you don't do the work. And that's why unions were invented. That's why people, you know, quit their jobs and find new ones, or whatever, because they feel like they're undervalued. And so, what I really liked about the Bee Movie is it really brought it to terms for people. It made it very relatable.
Right, teaching kids, you know, make sure you get paid for what you do.
Yes,
but I mean, in all seriousness, yeah, it's funny how you kind of have to trick people into learning something. And it's kind of one of the best ways that you learn, right? And teachers do this all the time, right? They'll trick you into learning something, or they'll kind of pose something to you in a different way in a medium that you are, you know, kind of already susceptible to taking in something new, and kind of just slip it in there, like the power of suggestion, right? So you're watching this movie, you know, and it's like you have a couple laughs and you're like, well, what's going on? Like, how is this movie even going to have any conflict? They're just bees. And then you're like, okay, they're working. Okay, I get that. And then they kind of put it into, you know, just in a way that you can grasp it. And you're like, oh yeah, and it kind of clicks for a lot of people, and they're like, that's what's happening, okay. And like you said, you can reach such a big audience when you have that kind of a platform, where you take a movie that's a kid's movie, put some science in it, and teach kids science. You know, like that's Bill Nye the Science Guy's whole, you know, claim to fame, and you know, the way that he was able to, you know, just kind of into this day, right, continue teaching people about science is just, you know, by his medium, his character, his kind of platform that he has to speak on.
Absolutely. And you know, this whole degradation of the bees and, you know, kind of the environment not being a priority is not just, you know, it's not just unique to the United States. It's kind of all around the world. You know, as countries kind of come to the forefront of the 21st century, you know, they begin to better understand agriculture and how they can, you know, use the land that's in front of them. If it's not the most efficient area to be able to grow crop or cattle or beef and use it to their advantage, and like repurpose that sort of stuff. And sometimes they overuse it. And I don't know if you guys are familiar, but in Brazil, essentially Brazil is like the lungs of the, is like one of the lungs of the earth. Like it's an air pocket. It used to produce a lot of oxygen. And with Brazil's agricultural revolution, there's a link in the show notes that talks a little bit more about this if you're interested. And I'm not sure who dropped this in, but this is an excellent link. I read through it and I really like it. So Brazil is really problematic because it's one of the biggest exporters of beef poultry. And so, but the thing of it is their soil is not meant at all to support that kind of thing. And the problem is they get so much rainfall that it really, it causes a lot of growth in that area, a lot of vegetation. And so all of the nutrients from the soil actually go into the plant life. And so it's not in the soil. And so it's hard to like really repurpose that for anything because it's already has its kind of prints already established there to do what it's going to do. What ends up happening is we wipe out, you know, football fields at a time of all this vegetation, and we wipe out all that. We take all the nutrients with it, and then it rains a lot, and it washes whatever nutrients were in the soil already into the rivers that are there. And so the soil is only good for maybe 5 years at a time, and they have to kind of keep redoing this over and over again. And they're doing it faster than the earth can keep up. And so their soil is just terrible. And they've replaced oxygen with methane with these, you know, with the beef and the poultry, and they treat them with hormones. So the meat's really not even that good anyway. And so it's really, really problematic. And it's like, well, why don't they do something about it? And the Brazilian government is more concerned about feeding their people than they are about the environment, which totally makes sense. I get that. But they're definitely, you know, a big contributor to, you know, a lot of the issues that we have with climate change.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy, you know, how fragile the whole ecosystem is, right? Where we talk about all these things, you know, that we're inspired by, and how we as humans have kind of gone from, like Lou said, hunter-gatherers, you know, and then like Jim said, you know, agriculture and how that kind of planted us in certain areas, and just how now, like Lewis mentioning, right, we ship things from place to place to place, which is an awesome thing, also a really scary thing, you know, in terms of how we're kind of offsetting that whole balance of nature, right? And like to your point with this whole, you know, Brazil thing, it's like, yeah, like once we start doing all these things, we're throwing a curveball into the system that has been here much, much, much longer than we have, you know? So it's always interesting to see like how we're kind of standing on that in between that balance of, you know, chaos and like what nature is, right? Like, how do we find ourselves kind of straddling this, this seesaw, for lack of a better term?
I mean, I think it's going back to my point of, you know, we have managed to use technology to make feeding our people much more efficient, and you know, hunger is not eradicated from the earth by any means, but it is much more scalable today than it has ever been, and we certainly have challenges that lie ahead. But I think it's interesting to point out sort of the opposing side to that is that we have modified some of the plants that we have sustained on, and some of the, you know, wheats and you know, barley and corn and all this other stuff that, you know, sort of we use as staples to go into many other foods. And because of that, certain things like allergies have arisen, and it's, a lot of that is thought to be because of how we store some of these plants. I mean, at least in the US, I know a lot of times the actual pipeline to for wheat to get to you know, common products that we use it in or foods that we use it in is sometimes it sits in silos for like years, and so it like molds, and a lot of us have grown tolerant to that mold, and we're fine with that, but there are those that their bodies aren't fine with that. And it's kind of crazy to think about that and to realize that, you know, we are sort of inflicting these wounds upon ourselves in some ways, and that there could be many other things that we
don't know the implications of, like cancers and such, that are caused by some of these, you know, things that we think are solving problems for us, but may in reality be caused by us in the long run.
That's a really good point. I don't know where I lie on the GMO side of things. I'm a little bit more concerned on, you know, what we do, for example, like with bananas, we clone them. And so the problem with cloning fruits is that they never adapt to new diseases that arise. And so if a new disease all of a sudden comes around, affects a bunch of bananas, all of those bananas then die. And so they never learn, their immune system never learns how to defeat that sort of disease that come about. The pro of it is that you can get a lot of bananas all at once. But the con is bananas are going extinct, and that's really problematic. And, you know, that's due to human interference. That is genetically modifying foods, right? So there's some really great positives to your point, and there's some really big negatives. I do understand that there are people who do experience allergies, and mold that is growing is problematic. So, you know, if we don't adapt to it, I don't know enough about GMOs to be able to really have a definitive answer of like, these are good or these are bad. As far as I understand, I feel like it's more beneficial than it is hindering, but I would have to do a little bit more research on it to really make a definitive.
I mean, I think there's a difference between, you know, like us tampering with something, you know, to make it last longer, right? Or us spraying something with insecticide to like make it, you know, resistant from bugs. There's all sorts of things where we're touching on this balance, but in a way that we hope will benefit, you know, X, or right, we're trying to get something out of it. We're either trying to get something that will sustain longer or whatever it is. But I think in the same way that we have, you know, vaccines, things like that, right? Like we've been able to solve a lot of problems, and we've always solved them with some form of technology and science, right? Like we learn something new, right? I mean, the first time they learned to, you know, pasteurize something, right? It's like, wow, we can get rid of all the germs if we just, you know, heat it this hot, and then boom, no more germs, right? Just things like that where we've used our understanding of the world to try to make it a safer place or a better place. And I think all of it is like, okay, if we're doing something, and I know Jim, you mentioned this too, like if we're taking something away, how are we giving back? Or if we're changing something, how are we keeping it in check? But I mean, like, yeah, there's lots of things that we have basically attributed to, you know, humans as being the main cause, right? And lots of negative things, right? Like we have, you know, pollution being a big one, right? Like the more people we have, the more basic byproducts that we're, you know, releasing into the atmosphere. And talk about climate change, right? Where, you know, since humans have been here, you know, we've had a large effect on just the nature of how our atmosphere works. You mentioned like deforestation too, right? Like paper products were a big thing, right? And we used to, you know, cut down millions and millions of trees, right? To make paper products. And we're starting to see those effects now where it was almost like, almost kind of like a, oh crap, oh shit, like what are we doing? Like this isn't a good thing. And now we're backpedaling trying to like fix all these things. But I think as humans, right, like we're always so concerned about us, right? It's a very much a first world problem. And for a good reason, right? Like self-preservation is one of our, it's just wired in our brains. So I like, yeah, we want to live, you know, we want to live as long as we can. And we want to make sure that, you know, other humans are able to live as well. But there's so many side effects to this, right? And I think it's interesting to see how technology, we've gained so many benefits from nature in terms of like learning from nature, right? Like, wow, we learned, you know, X, right? Or we modeled this out of nature, right? But we're not in a sense giving back. And we're in a lot of times causing more harm than we're doing good. So it's interesting to see kind of like that take on it, where even everything that you guys have mentioned, right? Like GMOs and, you know, moving crops and growing crops and this and that, right? They all have side effects that, you know, we don't really discuss. So
yeah, there's a lot of things that we take but don't give back. That I think that's a really good point. And I think that's a really big problem. You know, and so we, you know, we'll take things from the environment, and we'll, you know, it looks like, you know, we'll make lithium ion batteries, for example. You know, it's something in the show notes here is that, you know, that is a really big polluter. It's really bad really, really bad for the ground. Very corrosive, very a strong polluter. And they're really hard to recycle. I was reading over this. I was reading over this link, and I didn't realize how difficult it actually was to recycle it.
Did you read that whole paper? Right, like they're talking about, like, yeah, we have to have some special form of acid, you know, that will help us break down, you know, all of these components. And since, you know, in these lithium-ion batteries, there's all sorts of other things, and they're really volatile. We have to do this in a way that we can do at scale. That's also not, you know, throwing off all these other things, like. Yeah, and think of the sheer amount of lithium-ion batteries there are out there right now, right? And that number is only growing, right? You have people like Tesla building a giant battery factory, right, to just mass-produce all of these batteries. And it's great to say that we want to recycle every single one that comes back, but I think people don't realize that that's a really big task, right? That's a lot to ask. And that doesn't, you know, account for all of the other batteries that are produced that people just, you know, either throw in the trash or, you know, just toss out. And all that kind of stuff, like you said, those components are really volatile, and them going back into the earth in kind of like these condensed quantities is not a great thing.
Lithium is seriously one of the most volatile elements that exists. And it's so funny that it's actually a really efficient battery. I mean, it reacts violently to oxygen, right? I mean, it's exposed for a second and it combusts. It's the asshole of the periodic table. It's just mad at everybody.
It's like, oh no, I need to breathe. Oh, thermal event. What's up?
It's interesting you call it the asshole. I was trying to think through the periodic table for a moment. I'm like, is there any worse element? And sort of the only thing that maybe gets a little worse is some sort of nuclear type events that you could use certain elements for. But yeah, I get where you're going, Jim. And I totally agree that, you know, it is a huge problem, recycling. And I mean, sort of hats off for some cities that have done some significant work in boosting their sanitation department's recycling programs and really getting, you know, as much back as they can. And there's, you know, all sorts of efficiency metrics and things. But, you know, I think the world still has a lot of work to do in this particular department. And I think it's important. We talked for a moment about deforestation, but I think it's interesting in California, at least, we have kind of a local law that got passed that you now have to pay for bags if you want bags. And I think this is kind of a common thing. It's on the rise. But one thing I've been noticing is that more often now when you pay for bags, paper is an option. And I see people going for paper more than plastic. And I don't really know if that's really good or bad, but I think it's interesting that now paper is an option, whereas it used to be, I think plastic was the more common way because it was probably cheaper. And I don't know in the long run the impacts to the environment. I'm sure somebody does, but I think it's interesting that we are seeing more people go with paper, and I hope it's better for the environment in the long run.
Well, yeah, they banned plastic bags in California. Like, you can't have plastic bags. That's why everyone goes for paper, because if you don't have recyclable or reusable bags with you, it's the only other option you get is paper. And paper in this sense, like paper, they've gotten pretty good at recycling paper, right? Like a lot of companies will use, you know, 90%, you know, post-recycled, you know, materials in their paper products, right? And you have things like here's an example, like the drink carriers at like Starbucks, right? Like, those things are made of, you know, recycled materials, and they dissolve in water, like, within an hour. So paper is much easier when it goes into, like, oh, it gets dropped on the side of the road, or it gets, you know, left in this landfill, whatever it is. It's much easier to break down and kind of get just repurposed than plastic is, right? Plastic, you know, this thing that's, you know, just, you feel plastic, but you know it's not real. You know, it didn't come from nature in any way, shape, or form. Like, we made that, right? That stuff, you know, it wouldn't break down for years and years and years, and that was the problem, right? So it's like, okay, well, we have all this waste piling up, you know, and it's largely attributed to X. How do we get rid of X? Well, simple way, let's just, you know, say we're going to charge people for X, you know, and then in a year, we're not going to allow X anymore. It's like, okay, fine, you know, and that worked really well in our sense, right? Whereas, like, kind of slapping the hands of everyone walking by. I was like, did you bring you reusable bags? No. Okay, well, I'm going to charge you 5 cents per bag. I was like, dang it, I don't want to pay 5 cents per bag. That's so expensive, right? When in reality, that's nothing. And now everyone has reusable bags, or everyone has paper bags. And paper bags are much easier to recycle and much easier to kind of like repurpose.
So this may be like a bougie Northern California thing, but I definitely know plastic bags are still offered here in Southern California. So I don't know if that's just there, but yes, you do have to pay for them. And also your prices are way different than ours, because most places I see around here are 10 to 15 cents per bag. I heard 120 cents the other day, which I thought was awesome. I was like, wow, that's definitely an insult, 20 cents per bag. I really am glad that they're charging that. I really wish it would go to like 50 cents a bag, because people would really start to take it serious then. But that's interesting that you are noticing only paper bags in your area, because I think in the long run that might be better, for the environment.
Maybe it's because I only shop at places that supply paper bags, or no bags. Like, as an old man, my shopping trips consist of going to Costco, to just buy everything in bulk, because I have so many kids. Three is not so many, but it's enough. And then I go to Trader Joe's, which they only offer paper bags. So maybe that's just me.
Maybe.
Three kids is a lot of kids.
Three is a lot of kids?
Three's Thanks. A lot of kids. That's a lot of kids. Well, that's a lot of kids.
Okay, so here's the thing. Personal life stuff. All right, move aside all of technology stuff. Here comes personal life stuff. My wife and I, when we got together, we had our first child before we were married. So it was kind of, I was like, hey, surprise, I'm pregnant. Okay, great. So after we got married, it's like, hey, I only want two kids. Two kids is fine, right? So once we had our second child, we're like, cool, we're done, whatever. And then she got pregnant again with a third kid. And it's like, okay, now we've kind of crossed the threshold, right? Where it's easy. Like, I always wanted to, and this is something my parents always told me, is like, replace yourself on the planet, right? Like, give as much as you take. And now I'm kind of one of these people who I've produced more than, I'm going to take away, right? Like, when I go away and my wife goes away, we're still net plus one, in terms of like population growth. So I only wanted two kids. So I'm not saying I only wanted two kids, right? I love all my kids. But yeah, I only plan to have two. So three is just kind of like, it's tough too with like three kids, it's easy to kind of split responsibilities. Like, hey, you watch this kid, I'll watch this kid. But when there's three kids, you're like, okay, well, you watch this one. And then I guess we have to watch these two, and it's just hard to split, So to your point, Jim, three kids is a lot. It's not a lot in terms of like what other families have, but it's a lot for me, especially when we only plan to have two.
Yeah, it's just a ton of responsibility. I feel it, man. Like, I work full time, go to school full time, and I feel incredibly busy. I can't imagine working full time and having three kids, because that's three full time jobs. It just blows my mind. So my hat's off to you, man. That's really hard to do. And
hats off to my wife. She's doing most of the work there, right? Like, I'll leave in the morning and I'll come back and at the end of the day, and all the kids have been dropped off at school, picked up from school. So my wife's a real hero in the situation. But all right, so that's all my personal stuff that's out there right now, and we'll push that back to the side and then get back on the technology thing.
Claps for Adam's wife, and definitely I've heard Adam say he has three mouths to feed plus a wife, so there's a lot of expense that comes along with that too.
So another big problem is gluten allergies. I personally don't suffer from them. I don't personally know anybody who actually has a gluten allergy, but there are people out there who are allergic to gluten. Would either of you happen to be allergic to gluten or know anybody who is?
I actually do know a good handful of people. I in immediate, very close friends that I can rack off the top of my brain, four. My girlfriend has twin sisters, and both of those are allergic to gluten, and to varying degrees, very interestingly. My girlfriend, I did tell her, she went through a period where she tested too, because she found out the two sisters were, and they said, well, she should be kind of tested too. And so she tried this whole routine before you go
do any official tests. The sort of unofficial test was like, well, go a week without any gluten and then eat a bagel, and your body will kind of tell you automatically if something's alarmingly wrong. And because that large influx of gluten all of a sudden will just sort of shock your body. And so she did it, and of course nothing happened, which was nice for me because I didn't really have to change anything of my lifestyle. But I certainly know her sisters have had to do some serious modifications, and thankfully they found out about 10 years ago, and there's been a pretty big movement in the last couple of years to sort of be more tolerant to those that have allergies. And so it is definitely much more socially accepted today, and you see it on menus and stuff. So it's definitely getting better, but treating the root cause of it, I think, is something that, you know, at this point, I don't know if we're really interested as a society in treating the root cause of, you know, the allergy itself, and how we go back to, you know, treat and respect the plants to get them to the point where, you know, they are causing this problem for some humans. And granted, it's not very big, but it is affecting people.
So what is it? What do they experience exactly? I mean, do they just have a major allergy attack to where they need an EpiPen? I mean, do they have a headache?
Yeah. So one of her sisters has a closing up of the throat. So basically her esophagus just will go ahead and like close up and react. So she has trouble breathing, and if to further complicate things, she also kind of, it doesn't get very pretty, but I mean, her esophagus breaks out, and so it kind of rejects the food. And the other one breaks out. So there's a large amount of like kind of just rash. Her body will break out. So it's interesting how it affects different people different ways. And it does seem to be also in some ways passed down maybe in your DNA a little bit. Because one of her sisters has had a son, and they were really worried early on that he was going to have some allergies, and he kind of early in his life, just under 2 years old, was having some struggles with that. And he's since kind of grown out of it, so they hope it was just like short term, and he's grown out of a lot of his early stage allergies. I mean, he was, the poor little dude was like 2 years old, and he was allergic to like eggs and every type of fish, it seemed like, and a lot of nuts and gluten. So it was like, what can this poor kid eat? He couldn't eat like a birthday cake on his first birthday. So it was really rough. But some of that may go away with age, which is really neat for him. And it has gone away, at least for the gluten side of things. But other things remain. But he has to walk around with an EpiPen for the rest of his life because of it. So because some of the others haven't gone away.
You know what? I actually, I lied. I'm sorry to both of you. I do have a family member who is intolerant to gluten. He's also autistic as well. So he has a couple of things he's battling, but man, he's a freaking champion. You know what I mean? You know, he sees other kids eating whatever it is that they want to eat, and he doesn't complain about it. He just kind of takes it in stride. He's a really cool person. He's really young too. He's got a lot of maturity for how young he is, and you know, some of the mental hurdles that he has to overcome. So, when you were talking about what your family members have been going through, it kind of sparked that in my mind. But yeah, that definitely resonates. I couldn't imagine having to carry around an EpiPen all the time. Like I'm very lucky that I don't have to deal with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
So do you guys think that technology and nature can coexist? And do you think we would take more than we would get back? Or do you think we could be, have like an even relationship?
I think it's tough, right? Like right now, if history has shown any indication, it's tough for us to kind of maintain that symbiotic relationship with nature, right? Where we're kind of coexisting together and we're living in harmony, right? We seem to be more of a disruptor at this point, but I think right now we've taken more of a nature-centric approach, right? We're taking more of these things into consideration as we design and kind of develop technology. Hence all the things that we talked about before, right? Like using bees to, you know, help out with X, or to, you know, assist in the bee population. There are all sorts of, you know, initiatives for people to, you know, set up, you know, bee farms in their own neighborhood, or whether it's, you know, changing, you know, some process, or changing the way that we, you know, harness power, or in the sense of like solar energy, you know, things like that. And in the, even like how we're powering like large amounts of things like data centers, right? Where there's a lot of power going into those. And now a lot of companies are moving to, you know, power those by renewable energy, right? Something to where before we were just leaching all of, you know, this power that we would produce in dirty methods via coal or, you know, natural gas, things like that. Now, if we can do it with renewable energy, it's just much more effective for us, A, right? Because we can, you know, get this power for free. Hey, go figure. And then also not take away anything from nature. And it's tough to say not take away, right? Because even solar panels, massive amounts of solar panels do pose some form of threat to nature, right? Because you're offsetting something else, right? Like early forms of solar panels were, I believe, detrimental to some form of wildlife that flew around them because they were reflecting all of this this light back, and that was causing like temperatures to rise in certain areas, and then like certain animals can handle it. Like there's always been things with like wind power, right, with birds and all of that, you know, gibberish that people were saying, like, oh, you put up this many solar farms, it's going to kill all the birds. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, that's fine. But I think it'll be a long time before we're actually at a point where we can kind of live alongside nature and still continue to enjoy all the luxuries that that technology brings us, you know, right? Until we find a better way to, you know, harness power in the form of batteries, right? Until we come up with a new battery technology, you know, lithium ion is going to be there for a long time. And then it's, what do we do with all this old stuff, right? How do we get rid of that cleanly and responsibly? So I think for a long time, we're going to be leeching off this planet, you know, and just sucking it dry until we kind of, you know, get our shit together, for lack of a better word, and start giving back.
I definitely agree with you. And just to touch back on a point that you made about solar panels, I really like solar panels. I think they're a really practical and great idea, especially for homes, you know, for the individual use. And they even work on large scale, you know, and it's unfortunate that they do have the problems that kind of come along with them. And another really big problem with solar panels is they're made out of, you know, rare earth metals. And, you know, the mining of rare earth metals is really, really hard on the environment. I mean, we seriously have to dig so deep into the earth, and the way that we dig and the way that we get to those rare earth metals, and we get it in such small quantities, and we, you know, it has to happen on such a large scale that it really leaves a big carbon footprint just in the mining. And then to put a farm of solar panels somewhere, it seems like it's a big footprint as well. But I mean, I guess relative to the rest of the planet, the solar farms really aren't all that big. But still, there is a footprint there that isn't thought about, it, you know, because it all starts at a coal mine. It all starts at coal power. Even to make a solar panel, even to make an electric car, it starts at a coal plant. So I mean, it's never carbon neutral.
It's interesting. And I mean, Adam, I know you brought up the point of, you know, we kind of disrupt nature with solar panels, and we definitely have. I think it's innovative. You know, we've come a long way in that area, and today's solar panels, I think, have solved some of those problems. And I'm sure as we press forward in trying to solve, you know, to get to a carbon neutral point and in our giving back towards Earth, it's something that we are always going to be hard pressed to get to that zero point. And I don't know that I see where you're coming at it, Adam, and saying that it's going to be a long time. We're not going to be there anytime soon. And I think, you know, there are certainly ways we can work towards getting there. You know, right now there's the option of green roofs. And I really think that's a really unique option for cities in particular, where we've taken away, you know, New York City is a concrete jungle. It's a kind of the nickname, right? And there's so many rooftops I think we could turn into green spaces that could give back to, you know, Mother Nature, and whether they become gardens to sort of grow stuff and feed the people of the city, or they just become, you know, grass turf to, you know, just give off, you know, carbon dioxide or give off oxygen back to the earth. Either way, it's an option. And the other thing that comes to mind is there are definitely options for solar investments that are out there too. I know the other thing I dropped in the outline here was a company that I've heard of before that does some really unique and innovative things. And so I know, you know, it's popular to real estate invest. I know, Adam, I think you've talked about it on the show before, but you have some real estate property. And so one of those companies out there is this company called Wonder Capital that allows you to kind of put money in, and you're essentially just financing solar farms, and you're getting a return on your investment. And interesting, I mean, you could debate the logistics of like, well, what are they really, you know, out to do, and are their ethics all in line? But it is an interesting proposition to invest in loans that sort of are giving back to the earth in some way, shape, or form. And I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on, you know, that idea.
I mean, I was looking at this, and it's actually a great way because whether or not, like, it's hard to say, like, are they actually using all this money to do this, right? But that's something you'd have to decide, right? But financing something, because a lot of people can't put solar up, either because A, they're not in the right, you know, environment to put up solar, B, because they rent a house, right? Like, we're renting right now, so I can't put solar up in the house that I'm living in, but like the houses I own, I can definitely put up solar in, right? So it's just another way to, like, you know, yeah, you're buying an EFT, right? Or an ETF, you're buying that, and then yeah, you're getting some return back, but like you said, you're just providing a loan for these companies to go out and build solar infrastructure to give back, right? But I think humans are going to have to take, or like just even the consumer, right, is going to have to take a more, you know, solar-centric approach if that's going to, you know, take off, right? And there's been all sorts of, you know, different ways to incentivize that. But you see businesses are now taking, like, that's part of their consideration. That's part of almost their public image, right? They're like, hey, you know, we're carbon neutral, or hey, we give back X amount, or hey, we're powered by X percentage of, you know, renewable energy. And that's a thing that people are starting to care about. But I think when it's going to be, and this is the tough part, right? Like, houses are great things, but most houses are really, really old, right? And retrofitting houses with solar is not always the most effective thing to do, right? I put a link in here for, you know, Tesla. Like, we've talked about Tesla and their cars and their batteries and all sorts of stuff, but they have that Tesla roof now, right? Where it's actually roof tiles that have the solar microcell embedded in them. Right, and they're glass, tempered glass, so they're more resistant to like shattering, things like that. But for new construction, right, like the more that we decide to build around nature or build to complement nature, right, I think that's when it's going to get to a point where we're kind of at that neutral point. But it's tough because there's so much existing infrastructure out there. Like my wife and I were talking about building a house, right? It's like, okay, so we buy a plot of land and then we build this house on it, right? And it's kind of funny when you talk about the things that you want to put in a house, right? And, you know, let's say 10, 15 years ago, it was like, okay, well, we definitely want a pool. We definitely want, you know, central air. You know, we definitely want X. We definitely want Y, you know, all sorts of things. And now it's like, okay, I want, you know, all of our irrigation to run off of rainwater. Like, I want rainwater collection and to be able to at least run our irrigation, which is, you know, hopefully takes little to no water. I want to run all our irrigation off rainwater. So I want a rainwater collection system. I want all of our power to be generated from solar. And I want that to be stored somewhere for, you know, the evenings. And I kind of want like a carbon neutral, or like I don't want to take anything that I can't generate myself, right? Kind of taking back to like before we were, you know, all plugged into the grid and using all this, you know, electricity and things. I kind of want to get back to that. And like, that's my ideal house, but until everyone thinks that way, right, there's still going to be people, you know, I want, you know, central air, and I'm going to set it to 65 degrees in this house all the time and be freezing cold, you know, in the middle of winter, you know, and until all the companies get on, you know, solar energy or renewable energy sources, it's tough. But I think infrastructure is a really tough thing to change because of how long it's been around and how hard it is and how expensive it is to change. But that's just my two cents.
I really agree with that a lot. And really what I feel like it comes down to is that it's not just down to the individual person. I mean, it does have to start somewhere, but I think it's really important that we pay attention to how politics are going, you know, not just, you know, your local politics or your national politics, but global politics. I mean, the Paris Agreement is really important to pay attention to and to see what they're going on there and who's taking it seriously and who's not. And, you know, it's making sure that, you know, you subscribe to the idea of democracy. You know, if you want these changes, if you want a healthy planet for the future, for ourselves and our kids, you know, it's important that we pay attention to that kind of stuff.
It's funny how we always seem to like point out, we're like, we say all these things and we're like, yeah, make sure you contact your representative to do all this stuff. You know, we mentioned all these like crucial topics, and it's kind of funny how you can probably see which way all of us lean, you know, in terms of like how we're talking about things. But it's funny how like everything we talk about kind of relates back to some form of legislation, right? Just and how we navigate around this thing, which is why our podcast is about technology and culture, right? Because in all honesty, talking about technology is fun, you know, when you talk about the ones and the zeros and how things work, but it's really, you know, the more important thing, and I think this is, you know, why we started this whole thing, was like, well, what's the meaning behind this, right? Like, it's great to know why it works, and it's great to know why this is there, but it's like, how does that affect us, and how do we affect it, right? And I think that's always the fun part, and that's like the part that I like talking about, and I feel like hopefully you guys like talking about, and hopefully people like listening to. Just not another tech podcast, but something to talk about, like how things are going in life and how technology is influencing whatever it is that's happening in the world.
I mean, what a great point, because different cultures are going to have different technologies that suit their lives more easily. You know, the way that one country uses air conditioning is going to be different than another country. I mean, I know in India, they have a way of pouring water over clay pipes, and when air runs through it, it actually cools the air in the pipes, and it cools the air inside the building instead of using an air conditioning unit to cool or to pull out the hot air and pump cold air in. So, I mean, it's just one of those ways, because they had a really bad problem with sucking up so much energy, and so, you know, we use what nature already gives us, right? So, you know, I mean, that kind of gets into biotechnology. So, you know, these clay pipes is kind of a good example of that, where we that's something that we've observed in nature, where we see condensation on, you know, different trees and in different, you know, kind of vegetative areas. And when the air rushes through it, it actually cools that air and cools it as it's going through. And it looks like something else that we mentioned in the show notes is GMOs, which has been a really hot topic for quite some time. And I know that Monsanto was kind of at the front end of that, and he got a lot of backlash about what he's doing with pesticides and stuff with his crops. And we also do it with actual living creatures as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I think we've hit the point on GMOs, or at least I have, multiple times throughout this episode. But I mean, it is something that is both for the good and the bad. And I think we just have to weigh this cautiously. And, you know, I mean, like Adam said, you can kind of tell which way we lean. And so I tend to think we are avocado toast. We are kind of against the idea of GMOs maybe, but it has its benefits certainly. And so we have to kind of keep everything in consideration here and say that, you know, we do have a lot of benefits that come from that. And so we can't just say, no, we're not going to genetically modify anything, because it would certainly have ramifications if we pulled back instantaneously.
I don't think GMOs, and here again, I, you know, just to reiterate what I said earlier, I don't know enough about it, and I don't know enough about allergies to really make a definitive answer. But GMOs are naturally occurring. You know, that's, you know, Mendel's peas is a really great example of how he crossbred two different types of peas to survive in different conditions, stuff like that, and that was really beneficial for the food and the people who consume it. It wasn't harmful to anybody, and you got more peas and more food out of it. And so we've done that a lot with fruits. You know, a really great example is there used to be exactly, I think, in the realm of 12 different kind of pears, and now we have 300 types of pears that can exist in several different climates. And there used to be a fruit to seed ratio where the seed, it was 75% seed and the rest of it was fruit. And now that's kind of become the opposite, where it's 90% fruit and 10% seed. So you actually get more nutrients and more food out of what you're growing than just seed. So there are some really great benefits along with GMOs that aren't necessarily taking, you know, this gene from this organism and implanting it in this one, but just the crossbreeding of two different fruits or two different plants or two different crop will yield something that's stronger and more suited for that climate and can actually sustain itself. So in that sense of GMOs, where it's naturally occurring and we can put these two things together, I think is a really good thing. Where I think it starts to get into problems is where you actually like do like gene splicing, I guess is what we can call it, where we, you know, I know that we take, you know, like a gene from a jellyfish and put it in and use it as like a dye for different foods. And there are people who are allergic to that red dye. And so they can't have foods like that. And it's like when you do all of this genetic engineering, it's hard to keep track of where all that stuff came from and to put it on a label on your box. For the consumer to read all that and be like, well, I can't eat this or I can't eat this. And it says so here because, you know, it gives me all the information of where they got all this genetic information from, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see the argument on both sides. And I would have to agree, Jim, I'm certainly not as informed as I probably could be on this subject, but it is something I think, especially when it comes to our foods, I think everything in moderation, you know, is the old doctor phrase. I couldn't agree more with it. And so I think we just have to wade in cautiously.
Any thoughts, Adam?
No, man, I'm kind of like, I'm feeling all the head cold stuff in my head right now. And if there was a GMO, like something that could get rid of my head cold right now, I would eat all of it.
I've had such a hard time formulating sentences this evening. I'm sorry if I sound like I'm rambling on, but I'm trying so hard to put my point together.
It's okay. I guess I feel you, because I feel like the longer you take, like I actually understand it. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm following this train of thought. I got this. Like, you're going at the right pace for me, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm trying really hard to work with cold brain.
So, I guess, you know, we talked about like some examples of how technology imitates nature, right? And this is a subject that's always like just creeped me out. Like I always, maybe it's because I watched, you know, Terminator when I was like way too young. But the subject of robots, I don't like robots, and we'll get into that more at a later date. But I just have to say that robots that imitate technology really creep me out. Bees is one thing, right? Bees are bees. Like I get it. Like how afraid can you be of bees? You know, like when you're a kid, maybe they're scary, but I mean, when you look at robotics and kind of like how we, you know, how we take this fundamentally easy concept of like walking around, right? Where we think it's easy, right? It took us only like a year to learn. It shouldn't be too bad, right? But all of the terms of balance and equilibrium, this and that, and how all of our muscles and tendons and everything works together to basically get us to walk is kind of amazing. It's amazing we don't fall over all the time. So robotics, right? Like especially since, you know, they're still in this growing phase, right? Where we're trying to get to robots that can almost serve some of the tasks that humans can, or replace us in some of the tasks. But you look at, they're modeling a lot of robots off of nature. And I dropped a couple of links in the show notes here that you guys can look at your leisure. Of just like some very kind of creepy looking robots and stuff. So I'm curious, like, what your guys' thoughts are on creepy robots. And I'm totally like throwing bias your way, because I'm like, they're super creepy and they look like something out of my nightmares. And like the Matrix with a little squid thing that like crawled in his belly button. Like I'm out. Like nope. It's a giant big nope fish for me.
I actually couldn't agree more. Robots freak me out. I don't think we need robots. I don't mean that in every aspect. I mean, I like the robots where I can tell they're a robot, fine with that, and where it can actually be therapeutic in such a way where, you know, you have this robot that can lift, you know, people in a hospital to move them from one bed to another, whatever the case may be, where it's truly an assistant. That doesn't bug me so much, and I can tell that it is a robot. It doesn't look humanoid to me or anything like that. It's simply there to help me complete a task. But the actual humanoid robots, or the robots that look exactly like something that already exists, freaks me out. I don't like not knowing if it's machine or organic. I don't know if it's like intrinsic, like it's just in me that I just don't trust it.
Yeah, like I'm in the same boat. So like right now I'm staring, I have this like robot vacuum, you know, in my living room, and I'm staring at it right now, and it's got its nice little like blue light on, so it's like kind of chilling there, it's doing its thing, right? But it doesn't bother me because it's just this, you know, circle that goes around and cleans up all of the crap that I leave on the floor. And thank you, Mr. Robot, for doing your job every day. I appreciate you and what you do for me. But yeah, like when they have things that are kind of withering, like slithering through water, like eels, it's us imitating nature in the sense that, hey, this is how this creature moves around best in water. And that makes a lot of sense, right? So, okay, like if we were going to design something, what's the way that we could do it? A robot, let's say, to fulfill a task that needed to be underwater. It's like, well, how can we do this in the most efficient way that doesn't take a lot of power, that is its body's going to be well suited for the things it may encounter, right, in the water, in this, et cetera, right? So yeah, like modeling something after nature makes perfect sense. It's creepy as hell, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think some of these, I tend to agree with Adam. I mean, these things where we're modeling nature definitely seem a little creepy. The first link you dropped in the show outline here, Adam, of I forget what company this was, but I'm pretty sure they're like from like Boston area. It was those like robots that could like climb hills, and I think they were meant to be used in like a military setting, and you could like kick them over and they like get back up. Those things, I don't know, when they started out, they kind of creeped me out. But I think with all things in terms of technology, we kind of grow accustomed to them, and I've seen them for several years now, and I don't know why, but when I first saw them, they were very creepy. And as I see them now, they kind of get less creepy every time. So some of these robots in these other links are really creepy to me. And I don't know if over years of time, if I see them again, if they will sort of grow on me and I'll just get accustomed to them. But I know that first one, I don't know why, it just doesn't creep me out anymore.
Well, the first one, if you're talking the first link I included, is the GIF of, yeah, that Boston Dynamics robot, which Google bought and then subsequently sold again, which saying, "Ah, yes, motherfucking science!" Like, that's supposed to be light and funny, right? That was supposed to kind of, like, set you up for, like, oh, hey, it might be, like, kind of entertaining to look at this. And, yeah, that robot, which was, I think, called Big Dog, if I'm not mistaken. But that robot, yeah, it looked like almost like a vehicle, right? It ran and jumped and did everything like an animal would, but it looked like a robot, right? It looked like a piece of machinery moving around. But yeah, once you start looking at some of the other ones, right, ones that look like, you know, lizards or eels or whatever, then it starts getting a little weird. Have you guys also seen the video where there's that one robot and they're trying to train it, but they're like, it's trying to pick up a box and they keep knocking the box out of its hand? And they try to push the robot over.
Yes.
Dude, like that right there, my whole, you know, stigma with robots is like, oh my God, like I don't want to deal with robots. And I'm like, this is the thing that will start like the whole Terminator series all over again. It's like, if we're just, this robot, it's one job. It has just one job. And all it wants to do is pick up this box with the QR code on it and put it by this other QR code. That's all it wants to do. And this jackass human keeps fucking messing with it and knocking the box out of his hand, trying to push it over. And poor Frank, the robot, is just trying to get his shit done and he can't. And it's going to just, you know, take a little bit of time, you know, whenever, you know, AI gets to the point where it can think for itself. It's like, you know what? Fuck this box. I'm going to fucking kill you, Frank. And then just, you know, uses its superior strength because God knows we can't lift that 500-pound box, but this robot can, and just chucks that box right at you, and then boom, robot uprising, game over, we all lose, robots win, the Matrix is real, we all live in a simulation, we're all just batteries.
See, what happens when these, you know, when these robots become aware and they see all the cockamamie bullshit we've been doing to them over the years, and they go, this is embarrassing to robots. And we're not taking it anymore from you humans.
Oh, man. That reminds me of the Rick and Morty. You haven't seen it, though, huh, Jim?
I got to get on that.
So oh, bad. Dude. Okay, I'm going to spoil one thing for you.
That's fine.
And it's going to be amazing. So Rick is this genius, right? And he builds all sorts of stuff. And so basically, they're at breakfast one morning, and he builds a robot to pass him the butter. Right, so he builds this robot, and the robot's like, he's like, "What is your request?" He's like, "Pass the butter." And then he gets the butter and brings it back. He's like, "What is my purpose?" He's like, "You pass the butter." He's like, he looks down at his hands, he's like, oh my God. And he's just so sad, right? He's just, his whole sole purpose in life is to do this, right? But yeah, it's like, once they realize, like, wait, you built me to pass you the butter? Like, what the crap, man? So it's funny you mentioned that, because it's, if that doesn't get you to watch the show, like, I don't know what will.
I gotta watch it. I hear that it's on rickandmorty.com, so I don't actually have to purchase Hulu, so I think I gotta get on that.
Yeah, if anything, just sign up for the free trial for Hulu, tear through it all in a week, because it will only take you that long, and then just cancel your subscription.
Disclaimer, I'm not against Hulu, I just have so many other subscriptions that it's like, do I want to add another one? I don't know.
Hey, Hulu, when you stop trying to upsell me to get no commercials, like, then I'll actually care, right? Like, you offer me stuff, but it's like, okay, well, you can stream this, but we have to give you commercials. I'm like, I don't want commercials. Like, you don't understand. You're not understanding why. Like, yes, I pay $10, you know, for another service, right? Like, I'll put it out there. Like, I pay for Netflix, right? So it's like, I pay for Netflix. Hulu, are you really giving me something that much more? Like, we already discussed last time, I don't watch live television, right? But I do like, you know, episodes being available when I get them. But in the same vein, I also like binge watching stuff. So I don't like having to, like, piecemeal things as they go, which makes it a tough thing for me. So Netflix kind of gives me all the things that, you know, allow me to, they kind of enable my addiction and my habit, right? And Hulu, you're just trying to, like, stop me from doing it. And you're trying to charge me more money on top of that to not deal with fucking commercials. So Hulu, you know, come out with a plan that lets me do what I want to do for a little less money, right? And maybe don't give me every single show that I want. Like, give me at least a tiered option that brings it down a little bit less with no commercials, and I'll sign up again. And I've given them this feedback. So, like, full disclosure, like, I filled out that survey, sent that back to them, because they've tried to get me to come back like 8 times. And I'm like, hey, look, we'll give you a year, you know, for discount. And I'm like, no, I don't want that. Like, you're not understanding my problem here.
Hulu reminds me of, like, sort of very similar to the airline industry. It's like the basic economy of, like, streaming services. It is, you know, like, the airline industry has this, like, gimmick now where it's like, oh, you can fly basic economy. And, you know, like, you know, the, it's like economy, except you have to pay for carry-ons, and you have to pay for, like, checking in early, and you have to pay for, you know, every bag you bring individually. It's like, and it's just like the upsell at every turn. And it's, I don't know about you, but I would so much rather just be like, okay, so here's the fare, just tell me the price, and let me bring my one bag and my carry-on bag, and that's it. Like, just tell me the price it is, and don't, you know, include everything. I'm not saying, like, I, you know, you need all the frills that come with business or first class, but come on. Like, it's insult to injury at that point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I have HBO, I have Netflix, and I have Amazon Prime. And it's like, they all do the same thing. Do I want Hulu? Probably not. And now there's YouTube Red, and it's like, do I want that? Not really. Because I have these things that already do what you're offering to do for me, and they don't advertise it to me. So leave me alone.
I think ads are the thing that just, like, kill any service, right? Especially when you get used to, like, not having ads. So with Netflix, right, you never saw an ad. Never. So it almost became the expectation, like, when you signed up for a service and you launch the app, then you start watching something, it just started, yeah. Right? And then Hulu came along, and when it started on the web, it was kind of different, right? Because you were almost conditioned with YouTube to, like, expect ads, right, at some point. Like, okay, well, there's an ad, it's a pre-roll ad, I gotta watch it, and then I don't have any more ads. Like, okay, that's fine. And now it's like, I'm now paying you. I'm paying you money, and I'm still getting ads. That doesn't make sense to me, right? Like Lou said, it's like, why are you tacking on extra charges, right? You're just wasting more of my time when I've already paid you money to get on this damn flight. Like, no, I don't want that. And yeah, like Jim said, like, you have all these services, right? Some of them, you know, come bundled. Like, man, Amazon, right? Like, they're definitely trying to become the one company to rule them all, because, like, you remember when Amazon just used to be like a shopping online retailer, right? And that's all they did. And now they had Kindles, you know, now they have, like, smart speakers. Now they have grocery service. Now they have music. Now they have movies. It's like, oh my God, Amazon, like, I get it. You want to be everywhere and it's working, but I'm paying you, like, per year. And that becomes so transparent because you don't really realize that you're paying per year. And they offer all these things. It's like, you almost get service fatigue. It's like, okay, I know I'm signed up for X many services, you really have to offer me something, you know, enticing for me to sign up for another one, you know. And Hulu, like, they just don't cut it for me every time. Like, I've had this discussion, I can say, at least 4 times in the last year when I was canceling Hulu each time, because, like, I would sign up and then I'd be like, all right, no, I'm going to cancel, I'm not going to renew. And they're like, oh, why are you leaving? And I'm like, well, I don't want to. I don't think, you know, it's worth it. Like, I'm paying for commercials. Like, how about we give you, you know, like, the next 2 months are on us. I'm like, okay, fine, right? So I go through those 2 months and I try to cancel again. Like, oh, the next, you know, 2 months are on us again. I was like, okay, fine. You know, like, you're giving me free Hulu, I'll take free Hulu. And even in that time, I didn't watch any damn Hulu, right? So after that, it got to the point where it's like, okay, I'm just done. And now they keep, you know, calling me to come back. But I've had this dilemma so many times that I've pretty much isolated the causes. Like, I don't want ads and I don't want to pay whatever. I think it's over $10 or something like that to not get ads. Like, I don't want to do it. So, man, this turned into a rant about Hulu for way too long.
It definitely did. And I would love to, I mean, we'll never see the numbers, but the interesting thing to me would be able to see the churn for both Hulu and Netflix. I mean, obviously, I assume it's a lot higher for Hulu, especially at the rate that they're, you know, sending you emails begging for you to come back.
Well, what's funny, too, is like Netflix just increased their prices. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Thanks, Netflix. It didn't even bother me, right? Because I see the benefit I get from them, right? And maybe that's just, you know, like brand loyalty, right? Or that I've been part of the service for so long, I almost feel like I have an obligation to stay, right? Like all those cliche type things. But yeah, man, I don't know. I can tell you that I've almost considered like blocking that email address from coming, but I'm just waiting for the day where it's like, you know what, Adam, we'll offer you a lifetime of Hulu for free. And then I'll be like, let's do it. And then I'll never use Hulu still. It'll be the same problem, but I won't be paying for it. And that'll be what matters in my mind.
Well, we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier with, you know, kind of being symbiotic with nature and kind of working alongside instead of kind of interjecting ourselves into nature with human technology. So what are your guys' thoughts on the future of technology and how it's going to kind of more coexist rather than just kind of exist?
Are we still talking about Hulu? Because, I mean, that's what my brain is still on.
Oh, we can talk about Hulu.
I don't want to talk about Hulu anymore. I think I killed that one. Like, if Hulu ever comes up as, like, a potential sponsor, they'll be like, wait. If they listen to this episode, they'll be like, wait. No, sorry. Never. But, like, yeah, to answer your question, we talked about it a lot, right? Like, as terms of what we see happening in the future and what we think will have to happen. But I can say, like, the things that I see are us finding a way to harness what's already in nature to power the things that we need. And I think power comes down to ultimately the biggest kind of problem, the biggest hurdle for us to get over is, like, how do we generate power to, you know, fuel our homes, fuel our gadgets, fuel our vehicles, fuel everything without all of the detriments that we have right now, right? And I think whenever that breakthrough happens, most of the things will sort themselves out, right? We still have many other problems, but I think that's our biggest one right now, right? Is power. Is like, how do we generate and sustain power in a way that's not affecting nature, that's sustainable, that's renewable, and that doesn't have as large of a footprint or as Jim mentioned, you know, the requirement for precious metals, rare earth metals that we have today, right? I think when we figure that out, I think we'll be able to better sustain our homes, our technology, and we'll see things kind of work hand in hand to make it a better place to live for all species.
Absolutely. What are your thoughts on all that, Lou?
Yeah, I mean, I think Adam made a good point that it really does probably mostly boil down to power. And, you know, I think there are a couple interesting questions that come to mind when I think about the future of how we kind of blend technology and nature together. And those are kind of bordering on the lines of mostly for me, ethics and when do we overstep our bounds and go a little too far of in the blending. And so I think we just have to be careful in that. And I'll just kind of revert to my my past points of, you know, I think we just need to be cautious and we'll kind of find that line. But you know, I think for right now we're free to explore, and I don't think we can do enough too fast right now, because at the end of the day, I think right now we're taking more than we're giving back. So we might as well run while we can and try to give back a little more. And if we overstep our bounds, we'll have to correct that as it comes.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that.
Well, what are your thoughts on the future, Jim?
I really see us getting off of coal. I mean, I feel like that's going to be really our first big step is finally deciding that we're done using crude oil and we're done using coal, and we're moving on from that to sustain our energy, because we get so much free energy every day, more than we'll ever need, and we just don't use it. It seriously blows my mind. And you know, there are folks like Elon Musk who are really trying to be the forefront of that future. And I mean, I'll drop this in the show notes, but he's willing to rebuild Puerto Rico's whole power grid using his technology. You know, because, you know, they were hit with Mother Nature being Mother Nature right now. And he helped Australia rebuild their power grid because they had all sorts of power outages. You know, like, he really is the forefront of the guy saying, like, this is a problem. The way we consume energy is ridiculous, and we have the technology and it exists and we're just not using it. And so I really think our first big step into really coexisting with nature is to stop using coal to fuel our energy needs. I see that being our future. And it's inevitable. If we want humankind to continue and to thrive, we have got to change the way we consume energy. We have to. There's just no other choice, because the way we're doing it is finite anyway. So at some point we are going to run out. So it has to make that change, which it is. But in my opinion, it's slower than it should be, but it's happening. But that's what I see being the future.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I definitely have to agree with Jim.
Agree with Jim? He just said it was power. It was the same thing I said.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we're using coal for power. So,
I mean, Jim, no offense to you. I'm just being mean to Lou.
Well, this is into it all.
Well, yeah, man. Come on. Yeah.
All right. Well,
What do I have to say more? Yeah.
Well, let's wrap this thing up. So I dropped one link in the outline here that I just thought was a little comedic, and I'll find a nice article that kind of points to this, but I dropped just a link to a reporter who hadn't yet written a story. But basically, there was something that came up this week where it looks like Equifax, the credit bureau that we talked about a few weeks ago, was sort of hacked again. I guess one of their pages on their website was like redirecting to a download for Flash, and obviously it wasn't Flash, and so it looks like they've been hit again in so many ways, which I'm just shaking my head, and I really just want to send the facepalm emoji to them a lot.
Well, so yeah, you posted just a Twitter status update in the show notes, and I was like, okay, so then I actually dug into it more, and I put in a link. It says so much fail, and that goes to the Wall Street Journal article, which kind of explains what happened. And it wasn't just Equifax that had this, but it was just old code that pointed to like a defunct, you know, domain that just for an advertiser, I think they weren't using anymore. And basically, that would redirect to a malicious Flash download, which, you know, is like malvertising, right? Where they basically pose as another software in an ad and say you need to download this, and then they put, you know, the bot on your computer. What's really funny though is Equifax, you know, wasn't the only one to have this thing happen. It turns out their competitor TransUnion also served up the same ad. So whenever this, you know, domain was picked up by these, you know, these actors, and they replaced that, you know, that code with this this malvertising code, it didn't just affect Equifax, it also affected TransUnion, which those are like the two credit bureaus that my service Credit Karma goes to check whenever, you know, I want to get my credit score update. So it's kind of humorous how, you know, like, I'm sure, you know, they put this stuff into their, you know, their web app like years ago. And then, you know, when that company went out of business, like, oh, okay, cool. Like, we just won't serve those ads anymore. But all that code's still there. So when someone bought the domain, it's like, oh my God, this domain works again. Like, cool. Like, we can serve ads. And it's like, oh, wait, we're now serving malware. Yes. So yeah, like, same thing. Like, I mentioned Google Home doesn't get a pass, you know, when you turn on a microphone for always recording, even if it's a first offense. Like, Equifax, like, you don't get a pass because this is like your third offense, right? Like, oh my God, like, you guys have handled this so poorly and still they're finding like holes and problems in your software and just your service in general. So it's like, just give up. Like, it's time to, you know, just like fold, you know, go home, know when to hold them, know when to fold them. Now it's time to fold them. Get the fuck out.
How are they still in business?
Because they're like one of the main credit reporting bureaus, right? And most people, like, I know their stock has gone like way, way down, but their stock had gone up like three times, I think, since they were founded, right? So their stock has grown so much that even the dips that it's taking now, like, they're still worth a decent amount of money. And at the end of the day, I think they're still making money, even with having to cover for all this kind of stuff, just in terms of like what they sell to advertisers. So that's, I mean, I can't base that on fact. I'm just assuming that's how their business operates because that's how most of them do. But at the end of the day, like, no one's leaving the service because they're already signed up anyway, you know, like, it's just the reporting.
And I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, the way they're created is as a result of the credit card companies, right? Like, so the credit card companies are like, so we need a way to know whether this person is credible to, you know, lend to or to give our money to. And so by default, these, you know, these bureaus were created to say, well, okay, what we'll do is we'll keep track of everybody and you guys tell us monthly whether the user paid on time or not. And if they don't, tell us and we'll kind of create a way to monitor this. And anytime someone applies for new credit, you guys come to us and ask us whether they've been a good borrower in the past. And so it's there isn't really a good system, at least yet, devised by the credit card companies to protect us against this. And so I think this kind of goes back to why the credit card companies in general protect us when our credit cards are stolen or, you know, charges happen that weren't us, is because essentially they're kind of feeding their own beast and causing their own problem. Because if this system didn't exist, then maybe we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now.
Yeah. So kind of with this whole thing, right, we talked about, like, in our advertising episode about cross-site scripting and how things like this happen. And this is a pretty good example, right? Where you're on a site, that site being Equifax.com, and it's now executing code that redirects to another site, that redirects to another site, that is executing code on this server, which then causes, you know, the download alert to appear or whatever, right? So I threw a couple links in the show notes. Just to some things that block, like, all JavaScript, which would, you know, prevent a lot of these things from happening. It's worth noting that these do break, like, everything, because most modern web pages rely on JavaScript in some way or form. But the one I used to use when I use Firefox is it's called NoScript. And it's a great way to kind of, like, give you some transparency as to, like, what JavaScript, what scripts are running on a page and which ones you can allow and disallow, kind of piecemeal. So I put a link to that, which I believe is Firefox only. So I put some alternatives for Chrome and Safari for people who use those browsers. But all in all, I know there's a way to, you know, turn off JavaScript completely in most modern browsers, right? But turning it off completely does break everything. So these extensions kind of give you some more granularity in terms of, like, toggling that on and off. Just beware, it's not as user-friendly as, like, a lot of content blockers are. Because, like I said, when you turn off, like, JavaScript for, like, a main site, like, even site navigation won't work, right? Because even popover menus, like, rely on JavaScript in some way, shape, or form. So,
got it. Cool. I'll have to check those out, Adam. Well, Jim, I know you are, I believe, out next week. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm actually going to be in a wedding. Going to be the first wedding I'm actually going to be, like, in. That'll be pretty. Going to be really fun. I'm really excited. But I will be out of town. Will be gone.
Do you have like an important role in the wedding or just like a minor role? Are you going to be like featured in the credits or are you like top billed? Or
I'm not the best man, but I am a groomsman, so I will be featured in the credits.
Nice.
I was really, really flattered.
Very nice.
Yeah, like it's fun, right?
Yeah.
You just stand up there, do your thing, get to go to the bachelor party, which you did.
Stay up super late.
Yeah. You know, stay sick.
Stay sick.
Great. It's awesome.
I felt so terrible today, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, have a good time when you're out.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Nice little reprieve from dealing with us jackholes.
Oh, but I like you guys.
False.
Yeah, man. Have a blast.
Thanks, Luke. I appreciate that. But we gotta get somebody to fill my spot. So I know that we have a few people in mind. I haven't gotten any confirmations from anybody yet. But I will be missing from next week's episode.
We'll have all that sorted out by then.
But there's a mystery special guest for next week then, I guess.
Well, it was a mystery special guest the last time, too. I think just all our guests will have to be mystery guests from now on, because I think we're kind of setting that precedent.
Well, it's mystery to us, too, which is fun. It's mystery to our listeners, but it's definitely mystery to us at this point.
We'll just pretend that it's not a mystery to us, and we actually know what's going on. Just pretend like we don't run this thing by the seat of our pants, you know?
Okay, fair enough.
So yeah, mystery guest for everyone, but we definitely, definitely, definitely may or may not know who the guest will be.
Cool. Well, I guess that about does it for this week.
I think so. That was a really interesting topic. My major happens to deal with a lot of this stuff. This is a really interesting week for me.
Can you submit this podcast as like a homework assignment? Like, so I talked about all this stuff with three, you know, two people who don't know anything about it. So can I get an A now?
Can you just hand me my degree and we'll call it good?
Yeah. I mean, like, this is like my thesis right here. It's this podcast about people talking about nothing.
We are going to record this episode so fast, it'll be done by 10 o'clock.
Yeah, I really just want to go and take my 30 milliliters of NyQuil and go to bed.
Oh, absolutely. I hear that.
NyQuil.
It's amazing.
Did you guys see my Need It? My Nailed It?
I put that. Yeah, that's in the show notes.
I thought it was kind of funny. I was hope you guys found that funny, too.
I didn't click the link, but I assumed it was something humorous.
Did I change it back to nailed it? I might have changed it back to nailed it. I'm not sure.
If you did, it's fine. It's just I put a link for when Neil deGrasse Tyson explains, you know, Superman versus Batman. And then
What did he say? What did he say?
Oh, he says Superman wins.
Yeah, he's so stupid. Neil deGrasse Tyson don't know shit. I don't care all the stuff he knows about space and everything. But when it comes down to comic books, he don't know shit.
He doesn't know shit about Dick.
Space isn't the same in DC as it is in real life. Can we stop recording just so I can cough in peace? Yes. Now?
Oh, yeah. Let me tap the button.